I saw something around Thanksgiving that said my gratitude does not erase my grief, you know? And same thing, if my grief does not erase my gratitude, I can hold both. But it is certainly easier to do all this stuff and hold all this stuff when we're in a community that holds space, that is not judging us.
That was Dr. Red Hoffman, a trauma surgeon from Asheville, North Carolina, who is board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. We talk about the intersections between trauma surgery and palliative care, her own personal experiences dealing with caregiving and grief, and her podcast and upcoming TED Talk.
Hi, I'm Xian Xiao.
And I'm Sammy Winemaker. We talk to people who have information and tips on how to unlock a better illness experience.
The waiting room revolution starts right now.
Red, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, you guys. I'm so grateful to be here.
Yeah, it's so good to meet you.
So Red, you are a trauma surgeon. I'd love to start with you telling us more about what is this field of surgical palliative care that you're such a strong advocate for?
Well, one, I'll just backtrack because not everyone knows this, but you know, the founder of palliative care is a surgeon, and that's Dr. Balfour Mont. He was a urologic oncologist who I've gotten to interview twice, who is just such a gem. And so I always say, you know, surgeons, we have like deep palliative care roots. And also in the US, several of the first hospice programs, their medical directors were surgeons. So, you know, it's really interesting. I didn't really know this until I started delving into it more over the years. But surgical palliative care is a term coined by Dr. Jeffrey Dunn, and I call him the father of surgical palliative care. And it's really making certain that every surgical patient is approached with those principles of palliative care. And one of the principles that I love most about surgical palliative care is the idea of non-abandonment. So that even as surgeons, if we don't have an operation to offer you, or say we've operated on you multiple times and, you know, it just hasn't gone the way we would have hoped, and perhaps there's no more surgical interventions to safely offer, that we never say there's nothing else we can do for you. We just switch our focus and say, okay, let's kind of turn the tides a little bit and focus on the next step, whether that's perhaps more medical treatment and we can help you walk through that. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it is focusing on, or not unfortunately, it is focusing on that comfort. And like we all do in palliative care, focusing on quality over quantity.
That's so interesting, because who knew that the surgeons of the world would think about non-abandonment when we hear that so much in other medical specialties from patients and families, this idea that at some point there was nothing more they could do for me. And so there was no follow-up appointment made. And or this fear that if people don't accept the treatment, that they won't get the care. And so I think it is such an important point that you're making, that the best medicine that we have as physicians is ourselves. And whether you're a surgeon or a family doctor or other medical specialty, no matter what, we can always care for someone. And I think many physicians forget that. And then the patients feel dumped.
Yep.
So thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. I feel like many surgeons, that idea, like I think of my friends who are surgical oncologists, and they will still see their patients even after there's perhaps no further surgical intervention to offer. But I often feel very proud of my field of trauma surgery. I think because we spend so much time in the ICU caring not only for our sick trauma patients, but for other sick surgical patients, like it is just embedded in our hearts and souls to do good primary palliative care. And to really, we are often walking with patients. This is more, you know, I talk a lot about end of life care, knowing that palliative care is way more than that. But in the ICU, we're doing a lot of end of life care. But that we walk alongside our patients till the very end and really want to hold on to them. And we know, you know, I guess it, probably all over the world, that there's not enough palliative care doctors, so that we all have to step up and do our part and do that good primary palliative care, regardless of what specialty we're trained in.
Oh, you're singing our tune.
Yes, I bet. Yeah.
I know. Do you feel like this is a you know, because I feel like, you know, the common response is not what you're saying. And it's people really, you know, are focused on treatment. And then there is some point where they refer to hospice. And there's not really this integration of a primary palliative care approach is what you just said, especially with surgeons. I mean, do you feel like there is a change in the tide so that people can, you know, all healthcare providers know the ABCs of palliative care, or is it still a challenge, particularly with, you know, how hospice is delivered in the US?
Sure. No, I think I have to be mindful. Like, I'm living in my own little universe. So, and the people I hang out with, I don't think it's as much of a challenge. No, of course it's a challenge, but I will say, like, I just think of my hospital. I work in a community hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, 800 beds. And I, you know, our palliative care team, God, I mean, they're getting consulted. They can't see people for 2 to 3 days. You know, it's like they're understaffed. Everyone's asking for them. And so because of that, I've seen the culture in my hospital, not just with surgeons, with the neurologists, with the cardiologists, really start with our, like, in our medical ICU, starting to change because of necessity. It's like, mm-hmm. someone's got to have those conversations. And, you know, sometimes we can't wait 2 or 3 days. The patients are suffering, the families are suffering, and it's just mm-hmm. not appropriate to keep waiting. So I think mm-hmm. out of necessity, mm-hmm. things have changed. I think with COVID, also by necessity, a lot of us got mm-hmm. more comfortable talking about those really mm-hmm. quote unquote sticky topics because people mm-hmm. were so sick, and, you know, we are just mm-hmm. also slammed. Everyone had to do their part. So I really think that it is changing. And I think in surgery, you know, the American College of Surgeons and our committee there, and then I started this Surgical Palliative Care Society. I mean, we've all been doing a lot of work to, like, educate the surgeons coming up, the surgical residents, that, like, you can own some of this, you know, mm-hmm. I think sometimes people need permission to own this. I remember a couple of years ago, I was in the emergency department randomly talking about hospice with someone, and the emergency doc was like, well, I can't say someone's appropriate for hospice. I'm like, yeah, of course you can. You know, mm-hmm. like, you're a physician. I mean, you don't even have to be a physician to say that per se, mm-hmm. but I think it's just, like, empowering people that mm-hmm. no, we can all have a part in this conversation. People just, they don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That is the perfect segue, because our whole movement, the waiting revolution, was about giving patients and family permission to be more proactive, activated, and ask questions, because they didn't know what they didn't know. And we were trying to show them there's more information about your illness, and information is power. So I think you might have listened to some of our episodes. I mean, what do you think of this approach of going to the public and activating them to also be, you know, raise their voice to try to have more information about their illness and prepare earlier?
Oh, man. Well, of course, I love it for multiple reasons. One, I think, you know, having been a caretaker and now being a patient, like, I hate saying this. I love my medical colleagues and I love the medical community, but I think we can all recognize we all have a lot of shortcomings. And so being on the receiving end of care, I know firsthand that it is so important, say, even when we're going to appointments, to come. I come with my own agenda. I come with mm-hmm. my own set of questions. I do my research. I know now I'm a little in a privileged, right? Because I'm a doctor. But I think I see a lot of people online talking about this, saying, I'm going to my doctor. What testing should I ask for? Or what papers mm-hmm. can I bring? That, like, if we're, you know, all of our physicians are busy, if we help them along in our office appointments, we might all get what we want. So I think mm-hmm. that sense of empowerment is so important when we're either ill ourselves or when we're feeling, God, even more powerless as a caregiver, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's the most powerless we can feel personally, to take back some of that power, because, God, it helps the heart to feel like that, yes, we can, mm-hmm. Affect some change in our own well-being or in the well-being of someone we love. Now, I think I was just speaking with someone about this last night. You know, that attitude is not always met with love from the physician.
Yes. I was just going to ask you that.
Yes.
That is the number one thing that we hear when we're saying, oh, come on, we're going to activate you and you're going to be empowered and you're going to, you know, come to the medical system with a new mojo and a new vibe and get what you need. And many times we're told, you know what? It doesn't work. When I try, my doctor, ignores me or doesn't have the time and I don't know when to ask. Or they say, oh, you know, I get written up in the charts that I'm a difficult patient. So what do you say about that?
Oh, I was literally just talking to my boyfriend about this over dinner last night because he had a difficult interaction with one of his providers yesterday. And I was saying, I was very honest. I said, you know what, when patients come to me, I get a little activated. Now I know enough to check myself. I'm like, why am I activated? Because in the end, I will say those are the patients I enjoy the most. Because once I get over my own stuff, whatever that is, I love that back and forth and that shared decision-making. Well, I guess, you know, part of it, and this is challenging, is remembering that physicians are people too. So why do we get activated? You know, one, people have fragile egos. I don't think that's necessarily why I get activated, but sometimes, so maybe my ego's fragile. I don't like to be questioned. So, you know, like anything else, when you want something in life, you got to coat it with a little honey, you know? So maybe recognizing, listen, I almost acknowledging, I know you're really busy. I know you may know this already, but I've just, I'm so invested in my own health because I really don't feel good. Can you help me? And like, then the next thing is talking to their heart. This is what I was talking to my partner about. Like that when people say to me, I really need your help. Like, I don't feel good. And like, so this is what I read. Can you just sit with me for a few minutes? I think, you know, all of us do. We have a heart, right? So we can be buttered up and softened. And it's, listen, I acknowledge it's a shame that anyone has to play this game, but this is, I live in this world too. I mean, this is how I approach my physicians when I'm going. Yeah. But I also think it's really important to come with a list. Mm-hmm. Like you have to write it down, right? I get overwhelmed going to the doctor. I'm so anxious in the morning. I like get anxious about it for days because you really know, you know what you want. You're afraid you're not going to get it. Mm-hmm. So coming with that list. And then acknowledging too, we all, most of us, depending on the world we're living in, don't have a lot of time with our patients. So, you know, like we have to be, what are we going to accomplish? We'll probably accomplish three little things, you know, it's like, what meds do you want? What like labs are you looking for or diagnostic imaging? And then maybe one more thing, you know, so like being mindful that unfortunately I don't have 45 minutes to spend with you because I probably like double booked me already on my 15 minute appointment, you know?
Yeah. So having realistic expectations as a patient or a family member, being organized so that you're not wasting time sort of, you know, figuring out your thoughts while you're in the office, but also speaking to this other human's heart who happens to be a doctor and describing the why you're asking. Like you said at the beginning, like, this is really important to me. It's a really nice approach that you suggest. I remember I tweeted once, try this. And if that doesn't work, lock the door and don't let the doctor out until, but I really like your approach, which is more like a very sweet approach.
I'd add one more thing. Sorry. I think just remembering, you know, most physicians like don't have any training in therapy. And then like, so kind of acknowledging that, like all of us probably have, if you have a chronic illness or you're taking care of someone with a chronic illness, you're going to have a lot of feelings, but like knowing that it's your doctor's probably not going to be the person to process those with. And so, you know, caring for yourself and making sure that you're getting that love elsewhere, whether it's like with a social worker embedded in that office or going to therapy and like getting like, if you have 15 minutes, I'd rather you work on getting what only the doctor can give you, which is going to be the scripts and that workup, and then getting those other needs met elsewhere. It's a very special physician in a very special practice that's going to be able to give you both, you know?
Yeah. So this like realistic part of it too. Yeah. You need to know that it's not just the healthcare system that you're going to need to rely on when you're facing a serious illness, that there's other characters that are going to be important to support those pieces of you.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you tell us more about you mentioned you've been a caregiver, caretaker. Is something that you willing to talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I'll probably cry. It's sad. But in September of 2020, in the midst of all COVID craziness, that first round, my partner at the time, who was healthy, 40-year-old man, fell off a ladder at work and hit his head in just the right spot and had a traumatic brain injury. And I, you know, I've shared this before, and I say, even as a trauma surgeon, I mean, this traumatic brain injuries are like our bread and butter. I was so humbled. I'm still so humbled by how little I knew about traumatic brain injury. And no one ever taught me that truly traumatic brain injury is just it's a chronic illness that really requires like multi-specialty care that it was not really very easily accessible where we were living. And my partner had so many systems go awry at once, and trying to get to all those different appointments and put together a team, and being so close to someone else's suffering and not really being able to help at all. I mean, I was a great medical advocate for him, and I got him the meds he needed, but I was not a great caretaker. I have so much more respect for caretakers. I just didn't know the angst and the stress and the sadness and the desperation and all of that, the depression that comes with it. So that was our journey. We did that for 7 months and 2 days. And then unfortunately he committed suicide because he was just, his symptoms were so poorly controlled. And he was desperate to get out of that body, you know? And I can't blame him. It was a desperate situation. It was awful. It really showed me, it just showed me all the holes in our medical care. And it was very humbling, very sad. Yeah, but it did teach me a lot. And I learned a lot about traumatic brain injury. I learned a lot about what happens when people leave the hospital. Talk about a disconnect. You know, when you work in the hospital, there's that one world and then the people leave. And I had no idea. I had a little idea, I will say, probably more than most, because doing a palliative care fellowship, you spend time in the skilled nursing facilities and the long-term acute care hospitals and that sort of thing, and going to people's homes at some point. But I really didn't know the in and out for days, weeks, months, potentially years it's exhausting.
I don't know about in the US, but in Canada, it is not mandatory for doctors to do any rotations in people's homes or in the community.
Neither for us. I will say I went to a skilled nursing facility for one afternoon as a medical student, and I still remember it. Even that was very eye-opening. But as a palliative care fellow, I spent many months home care. But no one else really thinks about those sorts of things.
Hey, listeners, you're halfway through the episode. We want to remind you that our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, is available anywhere you buy books. Did you know you can leave a review on Amazon without purchasing directly from Amazon? All you need is an account. Reviews help others find our book when they need it most. Thanks for your support, and lots more of this great episode left, so keep listening. So Red, you have a TED Talk that is out now, and we'll put a link in the show notes, but can you give us a sample of what you talk about?
So I'm actually going to speak about being a survivor of violent loss. Survivor of violent loss, that's defined as someone who has lost a loved one to homicide, to suicide, to an accident, or to a disaster. And I've had multiple violent losses. My grandparents died in a car accident when I was 12. My father was murdered by a terrorist when I was 19. And then my boyfriend committed suicide. And so obviously this is something I think about a lot. And what I found, but didn't have the language yet when my father was killed, because I was young and hadn't gone through all this training. But what I found again when my boyfriend committed suicide was violent loss is really left out of the conversation around death and dying and grief and loss. And I think it really adds to the alienation of survivors of violent loss. And as I started to get more into this topic, and then this will be part of my TED talk, is talking about why violent loss, how is it so different? And one of the things I found that I love is the work of, his name is Dr. Edward Reinerson, and he's a psychiatrist in Washington State. And he has done so much work around surviving violent loss. And he talks about the two different distresses that survivors of violent loss feel. And that's the separation distress. That's the distress we all feel when someone dies. And then also the traumatic distress. Mm-hmm. So you have this separation distress where you're longing and you're like wanting to think about your loved one, but then you have this traumatic distress that's all about fear, and you're actually pushing that same memory away. And, mm-hmm. you know, in those early weeks and months, sometimes years of that traumatic loss grief, mm-hmm. those two kind of distresses are fighting with one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so hard for survivors of violent loss to even talk about what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. So that, thank you for coming to my TED talk.
I love it. There's a lot for workplaces and work cultures to understand about being around people who are grieving and have had losses, right? I mean, you just happen to be immersed in, like you said, trauma surgeons and palliative care doctors, but people who have experienced similar loss going back to the bank to work, or, yes. you know, going back to being a teacher or whatever. I think that's a whole different experience. So we have a lot to teach around that piece as well.
I think one of the things I love the most when I think about death and dying and grief and loss is that power of stories, and like that it's okay to say their name. And, mm-hmm. You know, my therapist, he used to say to me, my boyfriend's name was Brandon, and he said, there's no version of your story where Brandon doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I thought, God, it's so beautiful and powerful. And so if we can all just like, I feel so comforted when people want to say his name and just celebrate his birthday with me and ask. And that's something we can do regardless of where we work and who we are. It's just, you know, I'm sorry I didn't know your loved one. Can you share a story? I mean, I say that when I'm sitting in the ICU and the patients mm-hmm. can't talk to me. But that's something we can all do, you know, yeah. It's just asking, letting and inviting, right? The person might mm-hmm. not want be ready, but just having that invitation when you're ready. I'd mm-hmm. love to hear a happy story about your lost love, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the other big difference between a sudden traumatic death and a progressive life-limiting illness where it's an expected death over time, is the piece around anticipatory grief, right? Yes. That you didn't get a chance when Brandon committed suicide, or your dad was murdered, or your grandparents were in a car accident, yeah. to start grieving. And expecting that you're going to have these losses, your grief was harsh and started on a dime, like as soon as it happened. And so the survivors of a sudden death versus an expected death go through a different timeline of their grief, right?
Yeah, I would agree. But yeah. It is so interesting. One thing I did kind of experience that I'm assuming that a lot of people who are caring for a loved one who's sick for a long time is I did experience, and there was shame around it, is this, that sense of mm-hmm. relief.
Yes.
I was so like, oh my God, he's no longer in pain, and I no longer have to take care of him
yeah.
and fight for him every day and worry about him. There's a lot yeah. of me in there, and so much shame around that. And then yeah. having to like remind myself it's okay. It's okay to feel yeah. relief. And all of that. So it was interesting to feel both mm-hmm. parts. I was shocked, but not surprised about how it kind of played out with Brandon. So I had kind of both parts of it, you know? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think of, you know, that long goodbye is painful in its own way. And then that sudden goodbye, what does it remind us? It reminds us that, man, there's no guarantees. And so mm-hmm. Love hard, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had a lot of people feel very guilty about asking me about, you know, the timeline. You know, it's not that I want them to go quickly or, you know, but it's a legitimate question, right? How long are we going to have to pay for the extra services we have? Or, you know, how long am I going to have to be feeling this exhausted? There is a lot of shame from caregivers, you know, when they ask about how long are we in this for, you know, because they have grieved and they're tired and sometimes quite frankly ready. It's very interesting.
I guess just talking about it and normalizing it that I think now when I think of like all the caregivers I've interacted with over my career, I think they've all been feeling like that on one level or another. And I just try to really normalize it. For them, it's like, oh my God, of course you're exhausted. And like, you know, what's at the base of all that? In the end, we just don't want to see our loved ones suffer. Yes, we are tired and all that stuff. But underneath all that too, is there is that love for our loved ones who are just like suffering. And like anything else, it's like when you don't have an end date, you know, you think of like, God, you can even run 50 miles. If you know at the 50th mile, it's done, right? It's really hard to emotionally calibrate anything when you can't like know when it's going to be over. It's like never suffering with no end is that's a challenge.
Some people also describe that, you know, the community around them was not ready for them to pick up and go back to work so quickly or to find another partner so quickly. You mentioned you have a new partner.
I tell him all the time, you know, for me, everyone's different, right? Like I think of my mom, she's been a widow for 30 years and she's never fell in love again. And, and that's for her, you know, for me, I felt like I needed to give Brandon like another year and a day. I don't know why. And that, and you know, and after that I was like, okay, I have to keep moving here. But I tell my partner now, I think it takes a very special person to love someone who has lost, especially like who's lost young, you know, younger and who lost like I did. We live in the same house where Brandon died. I mean, it's like there's a lot of energy around here. And I think it takes like such a special heart. And I'm so grateful that I found that. I know I would be that heart too. Not everyone can. And you know, I've seen people, especially after long illnesses, we know like you have no idea what that couple talked about. You have no idea. And it is so none of your business. You know, it's like everyone is on their own journey, you know, and you just have to do what's right for you. I'm amazed at how many people want to judge. And I'm just like, you just have no idea what happened behind those closed doors or what was going on. Yeah. I do feel like, because I think as we all get older, a lot of us are going to love someone who's lost someone. And I love that idea of just still holding that precious space that that person did live and will always have a space in my heart. But, you know, our hearts are incredible. Just how we can love multiple children and multiple pets. We can love multiple people, especially when they're all not on this earth anymore, you know, makes it a little and less confusing.
we can hold multiple emotions at the same time too. Yes. We can be grieving and missing someone and sad, but also be in love and excited for a new relationship at the same time.
I saw something around Thanksgiving that said, my gratitude does not erase my grief, you know? And same thing is my grief does not erase my gratitude. I can hold both. But it is certainly easier to do all this stuff and hold all this stuff when we're in a community that holds space, that is not judging us. And that's just letting us play out. You know, I remember, I think, you know, when my dad was killed, my mom went back to work within 2 weeks, which I think is crazy. I was off for 6 months, partially because I was on short-term disability with long COVID. And I was like, and thank God, because I couldn't walk back into that hospital for a while. And I've talked to her and I just recognized we're a lot on like different places in our lives, different journeys, different abilities to access our emotions, you know, and again, that everyone's on their own timeline and there's no right thing. I think the worst thing we could do for people is to tell them like, you know, time's up. You got to keep moving. It's like, mm-mm. Like, no, everyone is on their own journey on this earth. Truly.
I mean, listening to you, Red, I mean, there's the whole like spiritual part of what you're saying. And that's a nice segue because you have a new podcast called The Surgical Soul with Red MD. So tell us what that podcast is about and, you know, what was your desire to create that?
Sure. So, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time because I'm part of the Surgeons Wellbeing Committee of the American College of Surgeons. But I will say my experience over the last several years of Brandon's death and then dealing with this, I've long COVID, so dealing with this new chronic illness the last couple of years and how that's affected my life and my work, it's just made me like, I know this, but it's made me think about it again, that we all have these quote unquote secret lives. And some of them may not be so secret. I like to share and put it out there. But it made me think about like all the surgeons I know and don't know who have these lives outside of the operating room. And this is not like some of the people I've interviewed so far are very much like me, very touchy-feely, talking about wellness and, you know, work-life balance and all that. But also like I have people on my list to interview who are Olympic athletes and who are doing all these crazy different things. It's not just about that touchy-feely stuff. It's just about the whole being of being a person, also being a surgeon, talking about how being a person and a surgeon intersects with one another. So I guess I was influenced by my own journey, but also really influenced as I just like am on Twitter or X and watching all these people do all these incredible things and then also going to the OR. And I'm like, wow, we need to like chat with those people. I'm very inspired, you know?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like the secret lives of surgeons, really.
Yes. And that's the tagline is uncovering the secret lives of surgeons, both inside and outside the operating room. So, yeah, I think it's like, I think of it like almost like the real Grey's Anatomy, you know, it's like, I've spent too much time watching that show. But, you know, it was really trying to show us like the whole, what it is to be a surgeon in the OR, but also like what it's like to have these relationships and how our relationships affect our work, how our work affects relationships. And again, how our hobbies and our other passions, you know, some people, all they think about is I just interviewed Dr. Maddox, who is 85 years old and is like one of the leaders in the field of trauma surgery, not operating anymore, but still so active in the community. And honestly, like he's so much about being a surgeon, but yet he was giving me a history lesson about Princess Diana and talking about like Egyptian gods and goddesses. I mean, like he has such a rich life that I didn't even know about. And I'm like, what a joy to hear this, you know? So there's a lot going on besides what's happening in the hospital.
Sometimes I feel so guilty that I don't have a secret like that. I have to find one. I want to be a doctor.
I would say revolution.
Sammy, are you like you guys leading a revolution? It's not a secret, but
okay,
it's a lot of work.
Fine. I want to be like a secret musician or like a punk rocker or something. I do have lots of secrets though, but I guess that's for another podcast. Yeah. But I don't have a secret life.
Yeah. But you know what? I have to ask this, Red, that, you know, I feel like there's this, maybe it's a stereotype, but especially in trauma surgery, that one of the skills that you would have to learn is how to turn off your emotions.
Yeah.
To be able to focus on, you know, the urgent situation at hand. But it seems like you have really tapped into, you know, you have easy access to flow into that and out with, you know, your palliative care hat and your emotional hat. So I just wonder if that's common and if it is really a stereotype that doesn't apply or if that is a skill that you know how to turn on and off.
Well, I think the ability to compartmentalize is, you know, perhaps introduced to us in medical school, but is baked into us, into our bones in surgery residency. It's kind of along that same ability that you could be dead asleep in the middle of the night, you know, on call, you wake, you get that page that like so-and-so's coding in room 202 and you're running up the stairs and like you're in the middle of a code, you know, like just we learn that ability to switch it on and off because we have to get rest, but we have to be able to run the code. And in surgery, I think we learn that ability because I always think once those drapes go up, I honestly really don't think about that person at all. Because if I do, it is like, it's almost too much. And I will share, there was one, I still remember this. I still see this woman around town. I love her. But there was one time where I became very, very attached to a patient that I had operated on. And she had some complications, I operated on her again. And then like 6 months later, she needed another operation. And it was like a tough part of the operation. I actually went out to talk to the family about, we really need to make some decisions. And I got very emotional. Like I was definitely too emotional, I would say. And I actually, thank God, I have the best partners. Like I called my partner in and he actually helped with the case. Like I needed his hands. He had great hands, but I also needed his like cool mind. He was not attached to this patient at all. So, you know, it doesn't do anyone any good for me to get over emotional in the OR. Mm. And I don't know how to turn that off 100%, obviously, but I know enough to call for help when that happens. But man, you know, so then I've been in those situations where then someone dies in the middle of the, you know, once in a while, I have an unexpected death in the OR. So you do what you can and then it's done. And then of course the tears come because it's just this emotional release. So that idea of being fluid, I think that surgeons are better at it than we think. Like I think of my partners, I mean, I just think they're all very fluid people. They're also, many of them are very creative, which I think that creativity, like I've multiple partners play guitar and this partner I'm thinking about that helped me in the OR. He's like this amazing woodworker. And I think tapping into that creative mind helps us to be more fluid, emotionally fluid, so that we can do our job and then go back to that world. And, you know, I think it happens not just in surgery. I think it happens in many other places too. But it's like a muscle that you have to exercise, because when I came back to work after Brandon died, I was like a bit too much in that emotional realm. I was a little messy for a while and I knew it was messy. It was in therapy, but I was still messy. And now I look back and actually, you know, I was very protected at work and really my boss kept me off trauma for a while, but even so it was like messy walking through the hospital or my partner had been hospitalized. And, you know, I had to do a lot of emotional work to kind of get those boundaries back again and to learn how to put up that wall so I could do my job. Because again, I'm sure you want your surgeon to love you, but first and foremost, you want your surgeons to operate well when they're in the OR, you know? Yeah. It's an interesting dance that we all do, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting. I bet you that muscle is what, in some ways, we need to teach caregivers, right?
Oh my God.
Like, you know, like they're so in it, but they didn't know that there is okay to have boundaries sometimes to be like, I can't do this. Or even to just that concept of, when I'm here, I need to be able to focus on this. But then when I leave, I need to be able to have my own time to process these emotions. And I can't be 100%, you know, the person. And it's not all about love. It is about love, but that can't be the only place that everything is coming from, because it's just too complex. It's so, I'm just listening to you reflecting back, because I think it's a skill that you have to be able to do. It's not that surgeons don't have emotions. It's that they're able to turn, you know, to focus, but then, you know, it sounds like they actually have a huge amount of emotions. They just have different tools and outlets to be able to process that, because they can't do it right, you know, at the operating table.
I think that is a wonderful idea. I mean, like, you know, I think it probably just like tease it out a little more, but that sounds amazing to like learn that emotional agility, you know, right? Mm-hmm. And recognizing that for the sake, just like I was saying, for the sake of my patients, for the sake of the loved one you're caring for, you have to learn how to be emotionally agile, or you are going to just be, in the end, right? You're just crying over the person you're operating over, and then you're not doing anyone any good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's your next book, you guys.
Well, no, that's your next TED Talk.
There you go.
Oh my
but we do talk about caregivers having to realize that, the art of caregiving is knowing when to lean out. You know, many caregivers lean in and they never dial back at all, and then get exhausted, especially like you said before, when you don't know when the marathon's going to end. So it's like this idea of knowing when things are a little bit stable, you need to back out, take care of yourself, take a small sip, go back in, you know. Like Sian said, the kinds of skills that we teach each other's care, the formal caregivers, like healthcare providers, but we really don't teach informal caregivers, family members and friends, how to remain resilient.
And also, I think one of the things I struggled with too is it felt almost so mean to be having boundaries. Like when you think of a healthy relationship, of course you have boundaries, and it doesn't feel mean to me at all. It feels necessary to have a healthy relationship, but it felt like mean to be establishing boundaries with someone who was unwell and struggling. But yet it's so necessary, not only for the person, but probably also for the person being cared for in the end. Like, I don't think I did that Brandon any good by not having boundaries, you know, but it felt, I guess like really addressing that. It felt awful to even think about self-care. I couldn't even think about it. I remember his, he was a workman's comp case. So we did have, I had this extra help. His nurse coordinator was amazing, but I remember her telling me, talking about self-care. And I was like, I mean, that's such a, obviously I know that concept so well. I couldn't even think about it. Like, I'm like, I don't even understand what you're, I don't even know how you would think this is a possibility for me right now. It's not. And yet, of course, in the end, I didn't do it. And then I just, it wasn't good for anyone.
Because the focus or the spotlight should always be on the patient, the wounded person, right? But there's another person in the shadows. We talk about the ripple effect, that any serious illness has an effect on the people in their, you know, inner circle, and everyone counts.
We sometimes like to end our interviews with what brings you hope? What are you hoping for the future, and what keeps you hopeful?
Well, let's see. Personally, I hope that our medical community continues to come together and try to find like some answers around not just long COVID, but about post-viral illness in general, which I think is one of many chronic illnesses that is underserved and completely ignored by medicine, which makes me very sad. And then I will share something that gave me hope recently. This is silly, but you know, there's a new Netflix documentary about the making of We Are the World, which is that beautiful song that came out. And I have to say that watching that, one, it's music, so it's like, you know, it just warms the heart. But watching that, watching all of these stars come together for the greater good. And, you know, the night that that was recorded, Quincy Jones put a sign over the door that said, "Leave your ego at the door." And like just watching the power of community. I mean, I actually was talking about this at one of our hospital leaderships meetings yesterday. It really just, I don't know, made me feel really good and inspired me. It reminded me of like what happens, like the beauty we can create when we come together. Again, we've been talking about community so much in this episode. Like that is the key to everything, is just coming with this open heart, accepting like all those people in the room. They were all so different backgrounds. Maybe they don't like each other, just different stages in their career, and came together to be a community, you know, and that we can do that too. And so I think that gives me hope.
I love
even though it happened like 30 years ago or whatever.
You're such a beautiful person, Red.
Oh, thank you, Sammy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Visit our website, waitingroomrevolution.com, for more information, to join our newsletter, and to check out our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. This podcast is produced by myself, Kayla McMillan, Shilpa Jyothi Kumar, and Maggie Sivek. And our theme music is Maypole by Ketsa.